Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small.
I've been wanting to come clean ever since 2005, and, you know, I didn't know where or when or how. Just been holding this in.
Steroids bulked up Mark McGwire's body, but they shrank his reputation in baseball and as an athlete. Now, will coming clean on his drug use make Mark McGwire larger? Drug shame, is it a path to the Hall of Fame? Go ask Mark McGwire. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, January 12th, and The Takeaway is redemption possible in the steroid era for Mark McGwire?
But does it change the fact that he was on steroids when he hit all those home runs? I'm not sure about that. We're going to be talking about McGwire all hour, but let's get right to the top stories. Some good economic news. The Washington Post is reporting that the Federal Reserve made $45 billion last year. That is the highest earnings in the history of the central bank, and those earnings, which are more than the expected profits of Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and J.P. Morgan combined, all that money will be returned to the Treasury.
But don't look for an increase in your tax refund. We don't get a bonus as a result of all that. Mark McGwire, it was reported first on the Associated Press, decided to come clean and admit he used steroids starting in the 93 season. He sat down with Bob Costas on the MLB network last night and admitted what a lot of people already suspected. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor. How big of a milestone is this in the steroid era, as we call it in baseball?
Well, he stepped out in front of this story and he said, "I did it." I think that that's a really important step for him to actually get accepted into the Hall of Fame.
Do you think he will get accepted into the Hall of Fame?
I think this will change the conversation now. Tony La Russa was going to said that he was going to get him an at bat in this coming season. That would have extended his eligibility because you need 5 years after you play. So, you know, at some point, I think he will get into the Hall of Fame.
Tony La Russa, of course, the coach of the St. Louis Cardinals, a mentor to Mark McGwire. Lots more to talk about this, and we will be talking about it later on in the hour. Thank you, Ibrahim. Meanwhile, back to the headlines. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are taking a toll on the mental health of veterans in the U.S. Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki says the suicide rates of returning soldiers continues to rise.
Of the more than 30,000 suicides in this country each year, fully 20% of them are acts by veterans.
Yesterday, we told you about a poll showing nearly 7 in 10 Afghans now support the presence of U.S. forces in their country. We wanted to learn more about this, and we're joined by Dr. Nadir Attash, a former Afghan government official from 2003 to 2006. Dr. Attash, do we actually know how Afghans feel about the presence of U.S. and NATO troops?
I think to some extent we do. We have a lot of anecdotal data and personal information that the vast majority of Afghans initially supported the intervention by U.S. and NATO. And given these past years, because of the problems, that support has dwindled. But I think even now the majority of Afghans support the process. And there is a simple reason for that. The alternatives are not great.
Well, we'll discuss those alternatives and continue with that discussion right after a break.
Sarah Palin's found an alternative. She's going to Fox News. She won't be hosting her own talk show, but she will be providing commentary for the cable network.
Asian markets were mixed this morning. European indices are down. Futures are down sharply. The Dow gets underway at 10,663. The S&P opens at 1,146. And the NASDAQ opens at 2312.
We're going to be talking more about Senator Harry Reid's comments about President Obama's race, and we've gotten reaction from you.
I think that he spoke what most white people do when you go in for a job. They look at your color and your dialect. So he was correct.
We're going to talk about work as we do every Tuesday. And today it's all about the racial gap in work. That's later this hour. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytakeofthetakeaway.org. Do you think, as Attorney General Eric Holder described us, do you think we're a nation of cowards when we talk about race? And is discussion about Harry Reid's comments, is that a sign of cowardice or bravery? 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll talk more about the Afghans and the poll about their country, showing that they think the country's moving in the right direction in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Many subjects in the American conversation this morning. We certainly started one yesterday talking about Senator Harry Reid and his comment about President Obama's light skin. We heard this from one of you.
I think that he spoke what most white people do when you go in for a job. They look at your color and your dialect, so he was correct.
Well, we're talking about that all day here on The Takeaway. We want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up in the workplace, what are the implications of the notion of light-skinned versus dark-skinned people in the workplace? And also, what about that revelation last night? Mark McGuire coming clean on steroids. We're going to be talking about that as well. And you can weigh in on that subject as well at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. But moving to Afghanistan, we reported yesterday on a new poll of Afghans. ABC News and the BBC did a poll of 1,500 Afghans that found a resounding 70% feel the country is moving in the right direction. That's at a time when an American troop surge is in the works and the usual quieting of violence that comes with cold weather has yet to occur. So mixed signals in Afghanistan. We're trying to get to the bottom of it. Dr. Nadir Attash is with us, former Afghan government official. He was a government official from 2003 to 2006, advisor to the Ministry of Finance and of Transport. Welcome back, Mr. Attash.
Dr. Thank Attash. You for having me.
So we were talking about anecdotal evidence that this poll is to be believed in Afghanistan. How do you believe a poll, even of 1,500 people in Afghanistan on a subject like this?
Of course, I have some issues with the methodology of the survey, especially in terms of the reliability of the results, because I'm this area that I have worked in this country a lot, so I know something about it. And I have done three surveys in Afghanistan for business climate in Afghanistan. And given the fact that we don't have census data and information about the population, it's very hard to do a scientific survey in Afghanistan. So I know the methodological issues. But even if you take the results with a grain of salt, there is a lot of anecdotal data that the U.S. is supported by the Afghan people in terms of the intervention because, as I said earlier, the consequences are the alternatives are really right. Horrible for Afghan people.
Well, we'll take anecdotal information. At least we're not pretending to be definitive or scientific, but anecdotal information is as valuable as any. Abdul Malik Niazi is a civil servant in Kabul. He's 38 years old and joins us from Kabul. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
What do you feel? The BBC published this poll yesterday that people in Afghanistan have definitely improved their view of U.S. forces, much more supportive of NATO troops in Afghanistan. Are you seeing that? Are you hearing that?
Yes, of course. Actually, the U.S. forces and NATO, they are listening to Afghan government, and they are also going according to the plans Afghan government is giving them. So now most Afghans, especially myself, I'm very hopeful if the United States and its allies go along with the Afghan policies, we will definitely succeed, and we have been succeeding.
And do you think that this is shared ethnically, that all the groups in Afghanistan, and of course there are many groups and there are rivalries within Afghanistan, and Hamid Karzai represents one particular ethnicity, is that shared by all ethnic groups as far as you can tell?
Yeah, of course. Actually, I possibly do not believe in different ethnicities. We are all one Afghan nation. And certainly we have a problem in some areas of Afghanistan, especially in south and east, where there are insurgencies. Whereas in other parts of Afghanistan, most people are seeing improvement in both relations with the U.S. forces and NATO.
All right. We're speaking with Abdul Malik Niazi, who is a civil servant in Kabul. And what you just referenced there, Mr. Niazi, Stanley McChrystal, the commander in Afghanistan, talked about warning Americans and other in the coalition to prepare for more violence.
I think Americans and all our coalition partners need to understand that this will be difficult. I won't predict casualty numbers, but I do believe that there will be a difficult struggle with the insurgency in the months ahead.
So, Dr. Nadir Attash, does that go together? A rise in violence in the coming months, even during the winter, which is unexpected, and an increase in support by the Afghan people for what U.S. forces are doing?
I think the two are consistent because I think one is looking at what is happening now, the situation. what is happening in the situation now in terms of the governance, in terms of corruption, people are not happy because we have not been able to deliver the services that the people want. But if you look at the results of the polls closely, it shows optimism. The people are optimistic about future. And I think here again, they have no other option but to be optimistic.
Although that's a sense they're being held hostage. I mean, they have no other option but to be hopeful. I mean, a majority of Afghans didn't even vote in the election. How translatable is that notion of hope into real signs on the ground that the economy is improving and that the life is improving for people in Afghanistan, Doctor?
And of course, that's our responsibility, the U.S., NATO, and the government of Afghanistan, to immediately deliver on some of the promises that we have made over the years for the Afghan people. If we, for example, could create some jobs in different areas of Afghanistan, if we can curb corruption, if we have proper governance, and we can do this immediately, I think the optimism would increase manifold.
Well, New York Times reporter Nicholas Kristof spoke on this program last week, talking about some programs that are very small scale that are having some success. Dr. Nadir Atash, as a former government official, listen to what Nick Kristof of the New York Times had to say, and I want your assessment here.
It really has had a remarkable effect, and including in building support for the U.S. And in addition, since the local people have helped build something, they resist when the Taliban come along to try to blow it up.
Abdul Malik Niazi, do you see local people resisting the Taliban because of small-scale efforts to improve development and life inside Afghanistan?
Well, actually, local people are now having a little bit problem with the corruption within the Afghan government, which the Afghan government is trying to tackle. So that's the only problem. Otherwise, the local people are fully supporting the current government of Afghanistan, which is democratically elected.
Hoping against all hope. All right, Abdul Niazi is a 38-year-old civil servant in Kabul, originally from North Afghanistan, talking about hope and support among the Afghan people for NATO forces. We're also joined by Dr. Nadir Atash, a former Afghan government official. Thanks to both of you. And now, at 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at some of the headlines we're following.
Labor leaders say taxing high-end health plans to help pay for healthcare overhaul isn't fair to the middle class. They say there could be political fallout if the tax is imposed, but stopped short of threatening to pull their support. Meanwhile, President Obama's approval rating fell to 46%. That's according to a new CBS News poll. The poll marks the first time the president's rating has fallen below 50%. Sarah Palin has a new job. Fox News says the 2008 Republican vice presidential candidate will serve as a regular commentator. And in San Francisco, a federal trial is underway to determine whether California's ban on gay marriage is constitutional. Jordan Lawrence, senior counsel for a Proposition 8 group, says the ballot box is the place to decide the issue.
If there's going to be a change of mind, there's ways to do it, but it's not to be coming into federal court. It's to convince the voters to change the definition of marriage.
The federal case may go all the way to the Supreme Court, possibly leading to a ruling that would apply nationwide.
In the Netherlands, Miep Gies, the woman who hid Anne Frank and her family from the Nazis, has died. She's also the woman responsible for saving Anne Frank's diary. In an interview with our partner, the BBC, she described how she handed that diary to Anne Frank's father.
I took the diary out of my desk and gave him it with the words, "That is a testament for your daughter Anne."
The voice of Miep Gies speaking years ago to the BBC. She died at 100 years old. Moving to economic news, it's bonus season at the big banks for the first time since they paid back federal bailout funds, but regulators aren't turning a blind eye to the payouts. Look for New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo to watch the nation's eight largest banks. He says he wants details on all those planned bonuses. And finally, more Americans filing for bankruptcy. Filings driven by foreclosure and unemployment rose by nearly a third last year. That's a look at some of the headlines we're watching this morning.
We're hearing from you about Senator Harry Reid's controversial comments about the light skin and speech patterns of President Obama. We'll take a listen to what you're saying in a minute.
Hey, you want that to go?
We got some takeouts on the news here on Stories We're Following. And first up, we've got a takeout from David Shepardson. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. And today we're talking about the X Prize. It's always great to check back in with this prize, David. This is a $10 million competition.
Yeah, it's been around since 2006. It seems hard to believe we're finally getting to the competition, but starting this summer, 41 teams with 51 cars are going to be competing to see who can build the most fuel-efficient vehicle and one that gets at least 100 miles per gallon or the energy equivalent of that.
Is this kind of a gimmick competition like those solar car races?
You know, it was a little bit, I think, but what they point to is the Ansari X Prize to build a private spaceship in 2004
yeah.
that actually led to a couple of companies being purchased by other major aviation companies. And I think it is a chance to have entrepreneurs and college teams show that, you know, there's a lot of innovations yet to be had in the auto industry.
So this competition, as you said, it's asking for cars that can break that 100-mile-per-gallon barrier. And that's kind of a magic number in the industry.
I agree. I think it's a number that people have thought about for years, frankly. But think about where the industry has come in just 4 years in terms of the big push on fuel efficiency and electric vehicles. You know, GM is going to unveil its extended-range Chevy Volt. Nissan has an all-electric Leaf. So I just think things like the XPRIZE have helped push the industry in this direction. And now we'll see who actually, after all these years of working, who's going to be the best and who's going to finally win the prize.
Okay, so this XPRIZE competition, the 2010 XPRIZE, at first when they were talking about it, it was going to be across the nation. They were going to have you racing from state to state, but now they've decided to place it in the Motor City. Is that significant?
Yeah, I think it's significant for a couple of reasons. I mean, Michigan has lost about 25% of its manufacturing jobs. In fact, it's lost about half of all of the manufacturing jobs that the U.S. has lost since the recession began December 2007. So Michigan's governor, Jennifer Granholm, and the state have really focused on trying to get more green jobs here, wind, solar, turbines. And part of that strategy is to get new auto companies to come here. And so I think by having the companies here for starting in April and the entrepreneurs through the end of July, they hope to make a big sales pitch to say, hey, come here when you want to scale up and actually start building these cars. And I think it reminds people that Michigan for 100 years has been where the bulk of automotive research and engineering has been done. And it's probably good on the publicity side as well as to try to, you know, encourage some of these people to bring some more jobs to Michigan.
Well, but David, I have a little problem with the logic of the XPRIZE. I mean, $10 million is kind of a drop in the bucket. And if you could actually get a 100-mile-per-gallon car, I mean, that'd be worth billions and billions. It's almost like saying, if you can come up with a cure for cancer, we'll give you $500. It seems like the incentive is already there.
Clearly, it's not about the $10 million. It's about the publicity you get and the fact that there'll be a big ceremony in Washington in September with government officials. I mean, this has been heavily endorsed throughout the government on all levels. So, yeah, you're right. It's not about this $10 million check. Now I can build my new factory. It's about all the great publicity that comes with it.
David, I got to ask you, we got announcements from GM, Chrysler, Ford, Toyota. Did I miss anybody? Mercedes-Benz announced at the auto show yesterday that they're going to be actually adding jobs this year. Do you think that's a result of the millions of dollars of funds coming out of the government as part of the stimulus package?
Absolutely. I mean, the U.S. government has spent over $100 billion in the auto industry this year, and there's a big push for more fuel-efficient vehicles. The government's willing to give companies, you know, hundreds of millions in cash grants that don't have to be paid back on top of loans. So, you know, absolutely, the government is putting money in and the companies are creating jobs. That's the formula right now.
I guess it's working the way it's supposed to. David Shepherdson, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News, thanks so much for joining us.
Lots of takeouts from you this morning. Yesterday we got in-depth on the racially tinged comments of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. He reportedly said, you'll recall, that then-candidate Barack Obama was electable because he was, quote, light-skinned and had no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. That's according to the new book, Game Change. And we'll be talking with the authors Mark Halpern and John Heilman tomorrow. But there was a range of reactions from you guys.
I'm Dan Turner from Mesa, Arizona. I just want to say that racism, to me, is to utilize race, color, ethnicity, skin color, to belittle, demean, disempower someone on the basis of such characteristics. How did Senator Reid do that?
Veronica has an idea. She writes on our site, thetakeaway.org, I struggle / chuckle daily when confronted with this glaringly ignorant notion that all black people emerge from their mother's wombs predisposed to speaking a, quote, Negro dialect. It's an insult to all black people, especially those raised by parents who've upheld strong family values, sound morals, good education, and who fostered a positive self-image and a sense of self-worth. There is such a thing as improper English that transcends race. It's a direct reflection on education. Meanwhile, there are several of you that wanted to deconstruct why Americans voted for Barack Obama, like Sheila.
Calling from Texas, I don't believe it's because of him being light-skinned, because the truth of the matter is that he's still black, and everybody saw that when he was being elected. I do believe it's because he's well-spoken and he sounds very polished. That contributed to it, but for the sake of his, you know, color, I don't think it really made a difference.
Meanwhile, David in Washington says, stop all the finger-pointing.
I think what the gentleman said about the president is an opportunity to discuss race. Why can't we come to the table and talk about it like intelligent human beings? Otherwise, we just keep putting it under the rug, sweeping it under the table, and we'll never get around to it.
That's right. We ask you to talk about it with us. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And we're taking your nominations for who's having a good week and a bad week. We team up with The Week magazine every Friday. Last time we said the Beatles had a good week when stranded passengers at Newark Airport sang their troubles away. What about this week?
Hey, dude. What about this week?
I was going to stop and let you continue that song.
How's it going so far? Are you having a good week or a bad week?
A
the
good week,
week magazine helps us
I'm
to
I'm going to nominate
out.
Myself.
You can, yeah, you're having
good
a great
week. I am. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a truly amazing story about a former guard from Guantanamo Bay Prison who tracked down some of the people he was guarding during his years at Gitmo to say, I'm sorry. Here's some of the news stories first that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A government report this morning shows veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have been committing suicide at a higher rate. Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki says the suicide rate of returning soldiers jumped from 26% from 2005 to 2007.
Who's vulnerable? Everyone. Young and old, outgoing and reserved, male, female, officer, enlisted.
Of the 30,000 suicides in the U.S. each year, nearly 20% of them are veterans. The news is better coming from the Fed. The Washington Post is reporting that the Federal Reserve made $45 billion last year. That's the highest earnings in the history of the central bank.
And that $45 billion goes back into the Treasury. And on top of that, President Obama is considering some new taxes on the big banks to refill the government coffers even faster. They're considering a tax on banks, either based on the riskiness of their loans or as a tax on the profits themselves. Community banks would be exempt. Mark McGwire has finally come clean. The former baseball star admitted he used steroids when he broke baseball's home run record back in 1998. He told the Associated Press he used the drugs on and off for nearly a decade. And for late-night talk show hosts, it's open season on NBC.
Hey, NBC said they wanted drama at 10. Now they got it.
Conan is right in the mix.
Leave television altogether and work in a classier business with better people like hardcore porn.
They've been at it all week since NBC announced it's planning to move Leno back to the 11:30 Tonight Show slot. No word on what's going to happen to Conan. Conan is reportedly considering a move to Fox. Let's take a look at the markets. Futures down. Dow gets underway at 10,663, the S&P at 1,146, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,312. Those are just some of the stories we're following this morning.
When they last met, they were on the different sides of iron bars at the world's most notorious prison. Now, a former guard at Guantanamo Bay has reunited with two of his former prisoners from Britain after he contacted them through Facebook. The two Britons spent more than 2 years at Gitmo. They were accused of being members of Al-Qaeda before they were released without charge in 2004. The BBC's Gavin Lee was actually present at their reunion. He joins us now. Good morning, Gavin.
Hi, Celeste.
So this former guard, Brandon, why did he want to get in touch? Brandon Neely, why did he want to get in touch with these prisoners?
Well, this all came about a year ago. He was Brandon, he's a police officer in Texas, in Houston, and he was He spent 6 months at Guantanamo in 2002, and it was, he saw essentially the very first arrivals of the first detainees, the first terror suspects to the base. And among those were two men from England. They were called the so-called Tipton Taliban at the time, Shafiq Rasool and Ruhal Ahmed. And he was told about these people, they were the worst of the worst. If you turn your back in a heartbeat, they'll kill you. And all of a sudden, he started to doubt just whether, in fact, all of them, you know, were guilty as he was being told, because he started to strike up this conversations, realised they spoke English, spoke more to Ruhal and Shafiq. And what's extraordinary is, because they're a similar age, they struck up a relationship talking about, particularly with Ruhal, Eminem, Dr. Dre, rap music, James Bond films. And Brandon started to think, hang on a minute, this guy, this, you know, British Asian Muslim from the UK got so much in common with me. And I think that's how his doubts started to crystallise.
It sounded like he also wanted to say something publicly about the prison. Here's what he had to say on your documentary.
I really didn't start thinking about Guantanamo until once I was out, and then the news would always try to make Guantanamo into this great place. Like, yeah, they were treated so great. And, you know, here I was really, you know, putting innocent people in cages.
So Brandon Neely started using Facebook. He found these two former prisoners on Facebook. They started having a relationship over this social media site. The BBC found out of it, and you orchestrated a reunion.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, Brandon's, you know, as I say, his doubt started to crystallise. He started to think that, hang on a minute, Guantanamo, in this Facebook message he sent to Shafiq, he you know, he thought, hang on a minute, I want to speak to these two guys again. It's been nearly 8 years. And, you know, remarkably, you know, how easy is it to get hold of people nowadays? You just type in their name in Facebook. Shafiq's name popped up, and he said, I'm sorry, I thought Guantanamo, for me, was morally indefensible. I've had quite a contact for a number of years with Shafiq and Ruhal, and Shafiq told me, he said, look, this guy from, you know, the Texas has got in touch. I said, you know, wow. I spoke to them both. I said, would you consider meeting face-to-face? They thought about it, and both of them said, you know, yes. But it wasn't an easy journey, because Brandon, on the one hand, was thinking, oh, hang on a minute, this is going to be tough. People didn't want me to do it. People called him a traitor. And for those two, Shafiq and Ruhal, they were, you know, they were bad memories.
So you were there, the reunion between them. This is actually a clip from the moment when this guard, Brandon Neely, was reunited with the prisoners.
Hi.
You're right? Yeah.
Okay.
You're all right.
Not bad.
Long time since I've seen you.
Yeah. You've looked different without a cap.
Oh, big difference. You look different with throwing jumpsuits.
Yeah, for sure.
That's kind of an amazing moment. It doesn't sound like there was a anger there or tension.
No, I mean, there was real tension, though, and there was real nerves. I mean, if part of the documentary, right before that moment, I thought Brandon may walk away. He was so nervous, and I always said, you don't have to go through with this. But, I mean, just as you heard, just to come up with such a quick response to, you know, you look different in the cap, you look different in the jumpsuits, you know, the orange jumpsuits of that time. I mean, that was quite quick. And quickly, Brandon, I think, as we'll hear in a moment, goes into, you know, to what he wanted to, you know, to come to see them for.
Well, this was his apologies. This is what he had to say.
But me personally, I'm really sorry for what happened there, and I wish I would have never took part in it, but I did, and I'm man enough to say I'm sorry for what happened.
Yeah, I'm really happy for Brandon to come out all the way here to say sorry to us. When people like yourself come out and basically say the same things that we were saying, it helped us so much for people to believe what we were saying was true. So I appreciate it from the bottom of my heart what you've done.
I completely agree with you, Shaf, and it's the government that needs to really apologise. You don't need to apologise, Brandon. It's not your fault.
Wow. I mean, Gavin, you know, listening to that, what do you think the value of a moment like that is, aside from for the individuals who take part in it? What's the value for people who maybe observe just purely from afar these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the situation in Guantanamo?
I mean, I don't know if it's recordable. It was such a strong message, and there was such a strong feeling of unity despite the cultures between them, you know, despite the things that the two men from Tipton have been through, and so forgiving they were. There are people, you know, even to me as a hardened journalist, just to I still get nervous when I listen to that moment they speak, and I've still, you know, it sticks with me. So, you know, that they've been through this and that they resolved something, and they went away as friends. You know, by the end of it, Shafiq and Ruhal said to Brandon, "If you're ever in England again, and please stay at our house, you know, and they became, you know, genuine friends.
Well, I mean, do you believe that they would? I mean, people say that often, all the time, when they're parting from people on good terms. Do you think that they will continue a relationship?
Well, that was the thing with this. I said to them all beforehand, however this goes, you know, if this ends up that you end up shouting or losing your temper with Brandon, you know, obviously if there's violence, we'll stop that. But this could end anyway, and I'm not, you know, just let it go. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. But so the fact that both of them said to me, Shafiq and Ruha said, I'm not going to take anything from this. I'll see what happens. And they came away and said, actually, we have got a small sense of closure here. I didn't expect anything from Brandon, but he didn't speak on behalf of the United States. He spoke on behalf of himself. He didn't say that Guantanamo was, you know, that they were all innocent people. He actually felt that just those two were innocent. And I think from what Ruhal said, he was genuine. And I think there's, I don't know, that will live with them and stick for them for the rest of their lives. And Brandon said that was the biggest thing he's ever done in his life.
That's Gavin Lee, a reporter for our partner, the BBC. He's talking about the reunion between Brandon Neely, a former guard at Guantanamo Bay, and two of the prisoners he once guarded there. You can see a photo of all of them at our website, thetakeaway.org. And for more on that story, check out BBC America and BBC World News at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks so much, Gavin. Coming up, we're going to be talking about race in the workplace. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. So Mark McGwire finally admitted what many suspected for years, that he used steroids while playing baseball. And while the information may not be a surprise, the intent and what he intends to accomplish by all this is something of a mystery.
I'm not here doing this for the Hall of Fame. I'm doing this for me, to get this off my chest.
Joining us now is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. This is a huge story for Mark McGwire and probably a huge milestone in the so-called steroid era. Why do you think Mark McGwire came clean now?
I think it partly has to do with his, I mean, I think that there is some truth in the fact that he wanted to get this off of his chest. I mean, he's been carrying this. He said he started using steroids in 1989. He came into the league in 87. He hit 49 home runs as a rookie.
So, I mean, he's got a record already.
He was a talented young man. He was a lanky, talented young man that exploded over time. He was caught up in the steroid era. So I think what he was trying to do was play a little interference because he wants to get back into baseball. So it seems as though this is a condition for him to get back into baseball.
Now, his emotion does seem genuine, but if we're talking about an orchestrated deal here, basically he's a batting coach for the Cardinals.
And that's the rub here, because Tony Russo wants to bring him on to be a hitting coach for the Cardinals.
And his sort of obscurity, since he refused to actually come clean about steroids, he actually took the fifth or pleaded silent in front of Congress.
Correct.
And has not mentioned anything. Has actually been a little bit surly about the whole thing when people have tried to contact him.
And the interesting thing there is that when you talk about cheating and you talk about baseball, his lack of admission in that, with that glare on him, is similar to Pete Rose when Pete Rose was asked repeatedly and repeatly over and over again. So you wonder.
Did you bet on baseball?
Exactly.
Right.
And he said no for 10 years, 12 years.
Right.
And so you wonder, is Mark McGwire in that territory where he seems as though he's almost indignant about his situation?
Is Mark McGwire looking at the A-Rod situation, where A-Rod came clean? I mean, maybe not completely voluntarily. It was a story that was broken, but then he did come clean, and his career seems to be intact. There will be an asterisk after his name to a certain extent. But then there's the Roger Clemens alternative model, which is fight this to the bitter, bitter end.
I think, to me, there's a couple of things at play. Major League Baseball is also at fault here. In 1994 to 1995, there was a strike season that ruined baseball for that time period. Attendance in baseball parks was down. People were sour on baseball in general. Greed was the name of the era. Then in 1996 and 97 and 98, Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa started hitting balls longer and farther and harder and more frequently than it had ever done before.
And it caught the imagination of the entire nation.
Precisely. And that filled the seats and created new stadiums and created a whole new generation of baseball fans. We were not complaining about it when they were hitting home runs. When Mark McGwire hit 70 home runs in 1998, no one said anything. But you could see all the signs were there. He was bigger. He had the telltale signs of being a steroid user.
But it's not our fault.
I would say
it's
that
not our fault. There is for living that dream.
That's funny. There's also something at play for sports writers. A lot of the sports writers that didn't call this out, that didn't push this and say, what's really going on here?
Well, he called himself out, Mark McGwire did. We'll see if he gets into the Hall of Fame after admitting his steroid use. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Sort of following on the Harry Reid comments that have been quoted so widely, is talk about race in the workplace actually a way of getting more diversity on the job site? We're going to talk about some serious numbers and obstacles to racial diversity in the workplace in our work segment in just a few moments. But right now, here's a check on leading stories. At 48 minutes after the hour, a federal judge in New York was asked to toss out an indictment yesterday against the first Guantanamo Bay prisoner to be tried in a U.S. civilian court. His attorney is arguing that his client's rights were violated when he was held for 5 years without charges. Prosecutors in Wichita, Kansas, are challenging a judge's ruling that lets lawyers for the man charged with killing an abortion doctor argue voluntary manslaughter. A hearing is planned today so lawyers for Scott Roeder may respond. And medical marijuana is now legal in New Jersey. Lawmakers approved a bill in that state that allows chronically ill patients to buy up to 2 ounces of the drug per month at state-monitored dispensaries.
A quick look now at the fight between labor unions and President Obama with our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Here's AFL-CIO President talking about this. This is Richard Trumka.
President Obama said in his inaugural address that the state of the economy calls for action, not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth. And now is the time to make good on those words.
So, Todd, what's got Trumka riled up is the fact that President Obama wants to pay for the health care overhaul by taxing Cadillac insurance plans, right?
That's right, Celeste, but that's just for starters. Richard Trumka was at the National Press Club. The National Press Club yesterday, not only to talk about the Cadillac tax, but to talk about jobs, to talk about Wall Street, which the unions don't think the administration is doing enough to crack down on bonuses. We're talking about bonuses today, to talk about college tuition hikes. Basically to say that this president and the huge Democratic majority in Congress has not delivered on their promise to the Democratic base. He had extremely strong words. I took it as a shot across the bow. You know, Trumka said, hey, remember back to 1992, labor came out strongly for Bill Clinton, and we were promised a crackdown on Wall Street. What we got was an emboldened Wall Street. What we got was NAFTA, which the labor unions hate. They say it's exported jobs to Mexico and overseas. He said, look what happened in 94. We tried, but labor didn't come out and vote, and you had the Gingrich Revolution. He said, there's no middle ground here. Working America is waiting for an answer, and time is running out, Democrats. He said those words, time is running out.
Well, if it's a shot across the bow, we'll have to see what the response is. Thanks so much, Todd. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
So our work segment this Tuesday on The Takeaway, really race comes to mind. There's a mission on the part of employers to increase diversity in the workplace. There's also a question raised by Harry Reid's recently published comments about Barack Obama's complexion and lack of a, quote, Negro dialect. Reminds us to ask the question, how above board, how on the surface is the discussion of race in the workplace, or is it something back behind the scenes, the kind of thing that people sort of conspiratorially worry about but never speak openly? Here's a comment we got yesterday.
My name is Dr. Diamond. Mr. Reid was right on target, and white people just don't want to acknowledge it. I don't think his comment was racist. I think that he spoke what most white people do when you go in for a job. They look at your color and your dialect, so he was correct.
That's a comment from an individual who weighed in at 8778-MY-TAKE, and you can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Keith Weich, president of Cub Foods, you're a diversity workplace expert. You're the author of Good Is Not Enough. If our listener is to be believed, the first thing you look at is skin color and dialect when someone applies for a job?
You know, I'd have to say that those are really discernible attributes that you do see coming in. However, I don't think that really factors in at the end of the day to the decision of whether you get hired or not.
But Keith, it's really he's outlining a perception that's a real obstacle for someone like you, wouldn't you say?
You know, actually, I disagree. Again, my thing is that no one breaks through the glass ceiling on their own. Someone has to recognize you on the other side and pull you through. And so I think the challenge is less about skin color and more about the fact that we need more mentors and sponsors or people on the other side of that glass ceiling.
Well, Beth Koblenner, of course, Takeaway contributor, who is with us on our work segment every week. How above board is the conversation about race, and how does it contribute to achieving racial diversity targets in the companies around the United States?
Right. Well, when you look right now at the current unemployment rate, for whites it's 10%, for African Americans it's 16%, and for Hispanics it's nearly 13%. So right away you see what the pattern is there. But the data that's most startling, I think, in this day and age is that the unemployment rate for African-American male college graduates is nearly twice that of male college graduates. We're looking at the same qualifications, and that's the widest gap it's been in years. So that is something that I think people are looking to and looking for explanations for. And one of the reasons is, for sure, that discrimination is still existing. I sort of poured into the research on this one. And one study I just have to tell you about really quickly, done by the NSF and Princeton and a whole bunch of very reliable sources, looked at low-wage jobs. And it was released just a couple of months ago. And they found that African-American applicants were half as likely to receive callbacks or offers as compared to equally qualified whites. And in fact, African-American and Latino applicants with clean backgrounds fared no better than a white applicant who was just released from prison.
So, Keith Weish, I mean, that is an enormous indictment of what human resources departments say they're doing, increasing diversity, when in fact those probabilities are so predisposed against African Americans.
You know, I won't disagree that, you know, on some level those facts are correct, but I will tell you that in this economy, companies are in such desperate need of change agents who can move the business forward that they are less concerned with what you look like and more concerned about the value that you deliver.
Well, you know, you mentioned before pulling people through the glass ceiling, mentoring people through the glass ceiling. Have you done that personally, and what companies do a good job at that?
Oh, I've done that personally, and every year organizations like Diversity Inc. puts out a list of those companies who really do that. There's always a top 50 list, companies like Verizon, Coca-Cola, Bank of America, what have you. And those are organizations where if you look at their workforce, 40-20%, depending on where they are promotions within the management level are from people of color. And so there are some companies who have figured it out.
I think that's absolutely, you know, true. They're Diversity Inc., Diversity MBA, Fortune, and Black Enterprise. They all publish lists, and they're all online, and they're all useful guides to companies that are very good about diversity. Two names that popped up in a couple of the lists, just cross-referencing them, were Kaiser Permanente, the healthcare company,
sure,
right, and the Marriott company. And just I looked into why, and it seems that the CEOs have a real commitment. They give bonuses about race, about diversity when executives are encouraging diversity. So there seems to be, you know, a way to find a company that encourages it. But I have to say, in this particular economic time, there are academic studies that are showing that in hard economic times, people look out for their own.
That's
and
the
diversity
thing.
Programs fall by the wayside.
And, you know, this is the thing for me. People can talk as much as they want about how much they have change agents or how much they want diversity in the workplace. But number one, by and large, many of these executives are white executives who are calling for more diversity. As in other words, we have not diversified the upper ranks of many businesses. And when the rubber hits the road, we still have these statistics showing that people with the same qualifications are not getting the same jobs if they're brown.
So, Keith, take us out on a reaction to that.
Well, again, the fact of the matter is those on the other side really are the ones who are calling the shots. And as long as, you know, right now you have 83% of corporate officers are white men, you're going to have that issue. However, there are organizations out there like the Executive Leadership Council, which is offices made up of African-American leaders, National Black MBA, the National Hispanic MBA. There are pipeline organizations where that next generation of leadership, that diverse leadership is there, and there are companies who are seeking people like that.
Well, it's a pipeline that seems to be flowing upwards in this economy if we read the numbers correctly. But thanks so much, Keith Weish, president of Cub Foods, former president of U.S. operations at Pitney Bowes, diversity workplace expert and author of Good Is Not Enough. And of course, thanks to Beth Koblenner, Takeaway contributor. Do you have a story about race in the workplace? What does your employer do or not do to close the race gap? And what about your fellow employees? Maybe you've been at the center of it all yourself.
Mike, Wayne, New Jersey. I've never viewed President Obama in terms of his skin color. Although I'm not a big fan of his, I see him as a very well-educated and well-spoken person. And that goes with the hiring process.
I'm going to hire somebody who is well-spoken and who is well-educated. And if they have neither of those qualifications, I wouldn't consider them.
Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or myTakeAtTheTakeaway.org.
That's how you can reach us on a lot of the conversations which are ongoing in the Takeaway family, like Mark McGwire admitting to using steroids while playing baseball and during the home run race.
Big surprise.
I was shocked. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or myTakeAtTheTakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
I don't use steroids. I don't.
You use caffeine.
I use caffeine.
You use a lot of it.
I started in the 93 season. Yep. And it led to all my records.
It's completely called into question all your radio achievements.
Can I have some more caffeine, by the way?
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.